Bryant Shannon versus Hampton Roads Community Action Program, Chester L. Smith Jr. Appellants Council, Joseph F. Burser, Jordan C. Heath Appellees Council. Please allow up to 30 seconds for transfer.
Mr. Smith?
Yes, sir.
You may proceed.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Chester Smith for the appellant. May it please the court. The trial court erred in granting H.R. Kep's demurrer in holding that the statements H.R. Kep Interim Director Tina Vick made in the disciplinary form were not defamatory, despite Vick's false statements that Shannon had abused her paid sick leave, vacation sick leave, violated H.R. Kep's email policy, and improperly treated salary employees as hourly employees in violation of federal law. For a statement, this court has ruled that for a statement to be actionable as defamation, it must have a provably false factual connotation and thus be capable of being proven false. And we would cite the Hanberg v. Goldberg case at 297 Virginia 660, a 2019 case. Also, this court has stated that for a statement to be actionable as defamation, it must have the requisite defamatory sting to one's reputation, which is the second prong of the threshold to be established as a matter of law. And also in Hanberg, 297 at 667. The court also stated, it went further to state, that the level of harm to one's reputation required for the defamatory sting is such that tends to injure one's reputation and to bring shame, disgrace, and scorn and ridicule and contempt, which is calculated to render him infamous, odious, or ridiculous. Hanberg at 297 Virginia 667. Vick's statements in the September 14, 2015 disciplinary form were provably false defamatory statements. Vick's defamatory statements in disciplinary form state facts that were provably false and were not protected opinion. Vick's position as interim director and her alleged viewpoint from that position do not insulate Vick from telling defamatory untruths per the Raytheon Technical Services Company versus Highland case, this court's case at 273 Virginia 292, where this court held that provably false statements of fact an employee had made in an employee's performance review can be the basis for an actionable defamation claim, 273 Virginia 304. In the Raytheon case, the court held that a false statement in an employment performance review that the plaintiff's business unit missed its goals by certain stated percentages could be grounds for defamation at 273 Virginia 304. The court in that case also held that a false statement in the performance review implying that an employee was responsible for visible losses that adversely affected the company could also be found defamatory at 273 Virginia 304. But in the Garrett Resources versus Jackson case at 271-29, a 2006 case, this court, where the defamatory critique of an employee was intended to harm his career, a similar motivation of the one Vick covered in the defaming Shannon, this court held that a company's chairman's false statement that a former chief executive officer's mismanagement had caused the company to lose money was actionable defamation, especially in light of evidence that the chairman made the statement with the intent to defame the former CEO so that he would not be able to go to another employer and get employment with them and cut the company out of the picture. In the present case, however, each of these statements alleged in the Second Amended complaint, which Vick wrote in the September 14, 2015 disciplinary form, are, as in the Raytheon case, facts which may be proven true or false and are not merely Vick's viewpoint. Whether Shannon abused the vacation sick leave in the manner alleged, whether Shannon violated an HR cap policy not to email staff while on vacation, and whether Shannon treated or countenanced the treatment of HR cap salary employees as hourly workers in violation of federal labor law are all statements that this court, all statements that can be discredited or established through the production of evidence. HR cap argues that Vick explains the factual basis for his statements within the disciplinary form and are mere opinion, and they cite the Schreckler case. which is in our brief at pages 15 to 16. But this is an incorrect statement of law because Schechter actually explains this principle applies only in the absence of a claim that the stated underlying facts themselves were false or defamatory. And we would cite for that Schechter 290 Virginia 106. Vick's false statements against Shannon in the September 14th, 2015 disciplinary form had the requisite sting to be considered defamatory. As to the defamatory sting of Vick's statements, context and inferences from the allegations in the complaint matter. The second amended complaint alleges that Vick held a long-standing, work-related grudge against Shannon and wanted to discredit Shannon and injure her reputation at HRCAP in order to eliminate her as a rival for appointment to the position as permanent executive director. These false statements were not mere workplace communications about office policy, especially in the context of Vick's antagonistic relationship with Shannon and given Vick's use of it in the disciplinary form. Evidence that a defendant bore a grudge against the complainant is admissible into evidence in a suit for defamation. We would cite this court's decision in Vaughn v. Lighton at 126 Virginia 671, a 1920 case. The obvious inferences from Vick's false statements in the disciplinary form were that Shannon had been involved in work misconduct and was unfit for her position as deputy director, as well as any possible appointment to executive director. The trial court failed in its obligation upon demur to admit the truth of the facts contained in the pleading to which it is addressed, as well as any facts that may be reasonably and fairly implied and inferred from these allegations. And we would cite the Turborda v. Daily 7, Inc. case at 271 Virginia 313, a 2006 case. A plaintiff may bring an action for defamation for any implications, inferences, or insinuations that reasonably could be drawn from each statement of fact. And we would cite the Webb v. Virginia Pilot Companies LLC case at 287 Virginia 84, a 2014 case. In determining whether the words and statements complained of in the incident case are reasonably capable of the meaning ascribed to them by innuendo, every fair inference that may be drawn from the pleadings must be resolved in the plaintiff's favor. We would cite this court's decision in the Pendleton v. Newsom case at 290 Virginia 162, a 2015 case. Because Virginia law makes room for a defamation action based on a statement expressing defamatory meaning not apparent on its face, evidence is admissible to show circumstances surrounding the making and publication of the statement which would reasonably cause the state to convey a defamatory meaning to its recipients. Again, Pendleton at 290 Virginia at 172. Vick's defamatory statements sting like those in this court's decisions in Raytheon and Government Micro Resources, with Vick's statements being provably false critiques or accusations about Shannon's past violations of paid vacation, sick leave policy, email policy, and favor labor law, each made with the intent to prevent Shannon from getting a job which Vick wanted. And we refer to the Government Micro Resources case 271 at 40. It must be emphasized here, again, that these statements were made on a disciplinary form addressed specifically to Shannon, no other employees, a disciplinary form just to her. So every false statement in the form pertains to Shannon and reflects directly on Shannon's job performance. Contrary to HRCAP's protestations in the brief at pages 18 to 20, Shannon argued Webb to the trial court regarding innuendo involved in the alleged defamatory statement, including any implications or inferences that may be actionable. Shannon expressly pleaded at paragraph 46 of the complaint that Vick's false statements asserted or implied that Shannon was unfit. Vick's false statements in the September 14, 2015 disciplinary form were in fact defamatory per se and not subject to any qualified privilege. At common law, defamatory words that prejudice a person in his or her profession or trade are actionable as defamation. We would cite the Carwile v. Richmond Newspapers case at 196-1, a 1954 case. As noted above here, Vick's statements were not mere workplace discussions, but were false statements about Shannon designed to hold her in a bad light before the community and members of the board to raise questions about her competence and to prejudice Shannon in her profession, so as to possibly make Vic's hiring as executive director more likely. The principle of qualified immunity protects a communication from allegations of defamation if made in good faith and by persons who have corresponding duties or interest in the subject matter. And we would cite here the government micro resources case at 271 here at page 43. To the extent, though, that any qualified privilege is interposed as a defense, Vic's statements were false, they were malicious, and they were published to co-employees who had no duty of interest or interest in the subject matter. And again, here we would cite that Vic's malice toward Shannon in making the false statements precludes any application of qualified privilege. We would refer the court to its decision in Cashin v. Smith, 286 Virginia at 327, a 2013 case. In order to, and in that case, where the defendant's malice was sufficiently shown in order to prove to support an award of punitive damages for defamation. In order to show malice, the plaintiff must show the communication was actuated by some sinister or corrupt motive, such as hatred, revenge, personal will, personal spite, ill will, or desire to injure the plaintiff, or what, as a matter of law, is the equivalent to malice, that the communication was made with such gross indifference and recklessness to amount to a wanton and willful disregard of the plaintiff's rights, the rights of the plaintiff. We would cite the Chesapeake Ferry Company versus Hudgens case, 155 Virginia 874, a 1931 case. The allegation of fact in the second amended complaint, taken as true, are more than sufficient to show Vic's actual malice and her sinister or corrupt motives, such as hatred, revenge, personal spite, ill will, desire to injure Shannon. The trial court erred in granting H.R. Kepp's special plea of absolute privilege. Neither this court nor any other appellate court in the Commonwealth has addressed the issue where there is an absolute privilege created in Virginia Code Section 60.2-623B. In accordance with these considerations and the rule in this court's decision in Brown v. Commonwealth 223 Virginia 601, a 1982 case, a statute like Virginia Code Section 60.2-623B allegedly granting any evidentiary privilege must be strictly construed against such a privilege if possible. To the extent that the court holds that some type of privilege applies in this case, no more than a qualified privilege should step into that statutory void to prevent an employer from maliciously defaming a former employee in accordance in accord with the ordinary privilege of an employer might have concerning the employment communications. We refer the court to the case I already cited, Cashin at 286 Virginia 336. This court should take this appeal and reverse the trial court's grant of H.R. Capp's demur and his special plea of absolute privilege because, one, the holding that Vic's statements in the disciplinary form were not defamatory are contrary to this court's prior rulings in Raytheon and government micro resources, and two, the court should hold that no absolute privilege arises under Virginia Code Section 60.2-623B in the absence of an express legislative provision for such a privilege. Thank you. It is my honor to be here. Thank you very, very much. I'm finished.
All right. You have 1 minute and 49 seconds left. Mr. Verser or Mr. Heath, which one of you is arguing for the appellee?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. This is Joe Verser, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Hampton Roads Community Action Program, Incorporated. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the judgment of the New Purnue Circuit Court should be affirmed for two reasons. First, the September 14th, 2015 memorandum was by no means defamatory. And secondly, the allegations contained in paragraph 35 of the complaint are subject to an absolute privilege that's provided by statute. With respect to the first assignment of error, Your Honors, if this court's jurisprudence on defamation teaches anything, it is that statements can be made that are offensive, unpleasant, harsh, and critical, but it doesn't necessarily constitute defamation. Whether a statement is defamatory is always a question of law to be decided by the trial court, And in this case, Your Honors, the trial court aptly carried out that function. The statement that the fact that a statement can be disproven as false does not automatically make the statement defamatory. In order for a statement to be defamatory, it has to carry a sufficient magnitude of damage to someone's reputation. And that's what this court means by the requisite defamatory sting. The subject matter that's being discussed and the statements that are being made by the speaker have to cast the person into infamy, contumely, shame, scorn. And in this instance, Your Honor, no fair-minded person can read this memorandum and say to themselves, what a loathsome person. I'm never going to associate with her ever again. And that's because, and I'm going to dissect the memorandum by each paragraph in just a moment, but whether your boss knows whether or not you're on vacation or not does not throw you into infamy. Sending an email is not a contemptible act, and whether there's an issue with other employees that needs to be addressed does not accuse the appellant of anything. Now, with respect to this memorandum, because these cases involving defamation are always fact-specific and it's on a case-by-case basis, when we look at this September 14, 2015 memorandum, the first paragraph, key sentence in that paragraph that the appellant disputes is where she says, I was not aware that you were on vacation for the entire week. That's disputed in paragraph 20 of her amended complaint. She hammers on that in her brief. And when somebody says, I was not aware that you were on vacation, what could be more subjective than that? It's clearly written from Vic's point of view. You cannot disprove somebody's state of mind. And that's why there's nothing contained in that paragraph that's actionable. I just imagine if this case were to be tried through to a jury, would we have a jury instruction that says, if you believe that Vic was aware that she was on vacation, then you shall find your verdict for the plaintiff. Again, Your Honor, there's no factual connotation carried in this paragraph because it's written from Ms. Vic's point of view, and she's basically, at the end, making a request. The last sentence of that paragraph says, there needs to be clarity and communication to me when you're on leave and when you'll be reporting to work. That's literally a request. It's not a factual assertion, and it doesn't carry any factual content onto the appellant. Now, with respect to the second paragraph, the accusation is, you sent emails while you were on vacation. There's nothing shameful or scornful about the act of sending an email. It's like if somebody were to make the statement, on Tuesday, I saw you walk over to the water cooler. And the person says, that's not true and I can prove it. Well, so what? There's nothing shameful or horrifying about somebody walking over to the water cooler, no more than there's anything shameful, scornful about somebody sending an email. And she even again ends this paragraph with the same request. I am requesting that when you're on vacation, please refrain from communications with the staff. Obviously, we want you to enjoy your vacation. If you're at work, work. But if you're on vacation, you're on vacation. There's no factual assertion being thrown at the appellant here. Again, it's a request. And then we get down to this third paragraph, Your Honor. And I'm going to concede that this paragraph is inartfully written. Because she begins by saying, I'm also aware that there's been an issue with salaried employees being treated as if they were hourly. Well, that's clearly an observation. But when Vic writes, I'm aware that there's an issue with salaried employees being treated as if they were hourly, we don't know who's doing the treating. This doesn't label on the appellant. It's basically a bowl of word soup, Your Honors, because we're trying to dredge out any factual connotation that is put on the appellant. She could, Miss Vic, if a fair-minded, reasonable person is reviewing this third paragraph, it could just as easily be talking about the appellant, that she was one of the employees that was being mistreated, that she was one of the employees that should be not being treated as though she were an hourly worker. And so trying to figure out what this paragraph says at all is a challenge, much less concluding that it's defamatory. And then the rest of the paragraph says, this is not going to be tolerated. The issue will be resolved as I've already contacted the Department of Labor. She's talking about future events. Going forward, we're not going to tolerate this. And going forward, I've already contacted the Department of Labor. So there's nothing factual that's being slapped on the appellant. When you read this paragraph, or rather this memorandum in its entirety, Your Honor, Ms. Vick is explaining how she sees things as the director. It's all perspective, it's all point of view, and the subject matter that's being discussed. When you're on vacation and when you're at work, whether you're sending an email or not, none of that is of a sufficient magnitude to be considered as having the defamatory sting that's needed in order.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. I ask you this on that third issue. Suppose she'd been clear and say, I really think you are messing up the difference between hourly and salary employees. Let's just assume hypothetically that that's what was intended to be said indirectly or directly. What is the sting in that? What's contemptible about that? I can line up a half a dozen labor attorneys and employment attorneys and get quite a lot of argument on the differences between salaried and hourly employees.
I agree with you, Your Honor. There's nothing defamatory about that. We're talking about disparate treatment between an hourly worker and a salaried worker. So even assuming that she's putting the needle on the appellant, the subject matter that's being discussed does not carry the requisite defamatory sting. Moreover, the example that you gave, Your Honor, is again spoken from the point of view of the speaker. It doesn't throw factual content onto the appellant. And I think it's important to note, Your Honors, as well, that the appellant places a false spin on each one of these paragraphs. In the brief and in the pleading, she gives each paragraph her own label. Quote, there needs to be clarity and communication between us. That is not tantamount to you abuse paid vacation sick leave. When she says, I'm requesting that when you're on vacation, you're not engaging in communications. That's not tantamount to you violated a work email policy. When she says, I'm also aware there's been an issue with salaried employees. That's not even approaching the allegation that she violated federal labor law. And I firmly disagree that this has been pled as defamation by insinuation or an innuendo, because nowhere in the complaint does the appellant allege that the language creates an inference of anything. It is crystal clear when reading the complaint that she's basing her defamation counts 1 and 2 on paragraphs 23, 24, and 25 of the complaint. She has honed in on these three paragraphs, and she's saying that those paragraphs, that the language itself is false and defamatory. She's not raising any insinuation or innuendo. She's referenced this Webb versus Virginia Pilot decision and Pendleton versus Newsom decision. In both of those cases, the plaintiff never alleged that the statements themselves were false and defamatory. Instead, the plaintiff alleges at the outset that the statements created a defamatory implication, and that's not what's been alleged here. There are also some allegations about the backstory and the relationship between Ms. Vick and the appellant. I would submit, Your Honor, that goes to, if the case were to proceed to trial, whether or not she can puncture a qualified privilege with malice. That goes to malice, and I would suggest that the appellant is mixing together two distinct concepts when she's arguing about all of the backstory and the lead up to this allegedly defamatory memo, because the court cannot draw defamation by implication based upon the history of the parties. That is something that can be meted out at trial to decide if she's overcome the privilege of qualified immunity through some form of malice. But there's only two options for the court. Either the language itself is defamatory on its face, or the language creates a clear implication that is defamatory. But in both instances, Your Honors, we're focusing solely on the language that's being used. In my remaining time, Your Honors, I do believe I would like to address this other assignment of error concerning the absolute privilege. I would suggest, Your Honors, that this appears to be an issue of first impression for this court, as this court has not passed judgment over Virginia Code Section 60.2-623. But it does appear that three federal district court judges and three circuit court judges have read this statute and have had no problem concluding that statements made during a VEC procedure cannot make its way into a trial court proceeding. I don't suggest that those decisions are binding at all on this court, but I do point that out to say that I believe I'm at least in good company when I make that argument. And I believe, Your Honors, that the public policy behind this statute is sound and self-evident. And that is that people should be encouraged, when they're speaking before the Virginia Employment Commission, to be open and frank and candid without fear of their words coming back to bite them in the form of a civil suit for defamation. And that's especially important, Your Honor, because the topics that are being discussed before the Virginia Employment Commission are by their very nature defamatory per se. We're talking before the Employment Commission hearing about somebody's fitness to work, their integrity in the workplace, and all of that content happens every day before the Employment Commission falls squarely into one of the four categories of defamation per se. So that's especially important why this privilege should be recognized and why it should be upheld by this court. And I would suggest, Your Honors, that the statutory framework here works beautifully to create the privilege. When we read this code section, 60.2-623, subsection A, it begins by permitting the commission to set out its own rules and procedures for handling these claims. And it says those rules and procedures need not to conform to the common law, not the rules of evidence, any other technical procedures. And that subsection, Your Honor, that informality is meted out in our administrative code at 16 BAC 5-80-10. Which provides that statements made by parties or witnesses shall not be taken under oath, and formal examination or cross-examination shall not be permitted. And so with that backdrop of informality that we have in subsection A of the code section, we then go down to subsection B of the code. And it basically says, okay, whatever is said to us here is off limits in any other proceeding. So let's put our hair down. Let's talk about how you feel. Let's talk about what happened. And that now brings us to the question of what's off limits. Well, information furnished. That is as broad a brush as the General Assembly could have found in drafting this statute. And certainly what somebody is saying before a deputy commissioner on a fact-finding conference call is going to be, quote, information furnished. And then what do we do with the information furnished? The General Assembly has made it crystal clear by saying it cannot be used. The General Assembly could have said it can't be offered in evidence. The General Assembly could have said it may not be read to the jury, but they didn't do that. They said it not be, and that is a broad prohibition as the General Assembly could have created. I also need to point out, Your Honors, that this prohibition is repeated again at Virginia Code Section 60.2-114, which references records and reports of the commission, talks about preserving the confidentiality and preventing disclosure of these public reports. And it says, information thus obtained, it goes on, nor shall such information be used in any judicial or administrative proceeding other than one arising out of the provisions of this title. That prohibition is referenced again in subsection D of 60.2-623. And so three different times the General Assembly utters this prohibition. And so, Your Honors, paragraph 35 is precisely of this complaint that they have filed is precisely, they're doing precisely what the General Assembly intended to prohibit with the enactment of this statute. And I think it's also important to note that this statute, Your Honors, protects both employers and employees. The appellant cannot dredge up what was said about her at an employment commission hearing, nor can I bring up the commission's decision at trial. And in this case, Your Honor, the commission found her to have been terminated for cause, not once but twice. And can't Your Honors just imagine how I would love to use that on cross-examination at trial? But I can't, because the General Assembly has cast a blanket over that. And I would respectfully ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision.
All right, Mr. Verscher, thank you for your argument. Mr. Smith, do you have any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. In my 1 minute remaining, I would say to the court that you cannot walk into a Virginia Employment Commission hearing and accuse anyone, let alone the former employee, for example, of threatening to kill my sister or threatening to use drugs, and then say, oh, I have immunity, I have absolute immunity. You can't do that. This court never intended for someone to have absolute immunity in that court or in that setting. And lastly, I would say to the court that this is not, first of all, she's not an hourly employee. The appellant, Your Honors, is not an hourly employee. But the thing that stands out here, this is not a general form to all employees, Your Honor. This is not a general notice for the betterment of a company. This is a disciplinary form, where she is disciplining someone, and each of the allegations in the disciplinary form are false, and they are known to be false. They're provably false. Emails of violation, false. Taking leave, false. She states in the disciplinary form, this will not be tolerated. And all of the allegations, stealing emails, all of those are false. She intended this to be directly communicated to the appellant in that setting and no one else. This is not for the betterment of the company. She could have used another form. And I would submit to the court that, this is not by accident. This is not by accident. This is directly intended to discipline this employee. That's why the form was used. And that's why the statements there were made with the anger and the gust that she had against her. Thank you all.
All right. Thank you for your argument. The court will take a brief recess until 10:45.